Welcome to Yale Cancer Center Answers with Drs. Francine Foss and Anise Chagpar. Dr. Foss is a professor of medical oncology and dermatology specializing in the treatment of lymphomas. Dr. Chagpar is associate professor of surgical oncology and director of the Breast Center at Smilow Cancer Hospital at Yale New Haven. If you'd like to join the conversation, you can contact the doctors directly. The address is canceranswers@yale.edu and the phone number is 1-888-234-4YCC. This week, I'll be sitting in for Drs. Foss and Chagpar for a conversation about integrative oncology and healthy aging with Dr. Donald Abrams. Dr. Abrams is a cancer and integrative medicine specialist at the UCSF Osher Center for Integrative Medicine. I'd like to begin with, what exactly is integrative medicine? I think it's something that a lot of people just don't know.
Really, integrative medicine is patient-centered medicine where the patient is the most important thing, not their disease. And what we do in integrative medicine is get to know the patient, spend time with the patient, and use evidence as much as possible to create a regimen for the patient that combines the best of conventional and complementary therapies.
Now, is this something that started in medicine and then moved to oncology, or was it the other way around, or did they evolve at the same time?
So integrative medicine is not to be confused with so-called CAM, complementary and alternative medicine, but it certainly is an outgrowth of complementary and alternative medicine. That's a term I think we need to get away from, because complementary means that the therapy is used in conjunction with, and alternative means it's used instead of. So putting them together as the acronym CAM makes no sense, because nothing is usually complementary and alternative. It turns out that cancer patients, because they have a disease that's often incurable, are very heavy users of complementary therapies. So integrative medicine is a field that didn't necessarily start around cancer, but integrative medicine is something that's quite applicable to patients with malignant disease.
Did it have its genesis in helping cancer patients, or did it start with just regular?
You know, it's a good question. What is the origins of integrative medicine? It's something that's evolved over the past 20 years, I'd say. And currently, 57 academic medical centers in the United States belong to the consortium of academic health centers in integrative medicine, including Yale. There is Yale Integrative Medicine on campus. It's just something that, depending on where you are, integrative medicine is either relegated to something that people feel is quite fringy, or otherwise it's quite integrative into the healthcare system. And I think more and more, as baby boomers age and get sick, the demand to look at non-conventional interventions as part of treatment is going to increase.
And I want to come back to that, but start now, give a little context to your background. First of all, just how did you get interested as a kid in medicine?
So my temple folded after my bar mitzvah. They wanted me to be a rabbi, but you know, that didn't work. I come from a long line of a family that has no physicians at all, but I just always knew that I was going to be a doctor and, you know, followed that path. I went to Brown as an undergraduate and was in their, what was at that time, a 6-year Master of Medical Science program that ultimately was going to lead to a 7-year MD. But in the middle of that, I went to Amsterdam for my first time ever out of the country in 1971, you can imagine, and decided I don't want to spend the rest of my life in Providence, although I liked it. You know, growing up in Cleveland, Providence was... Anyway, so I decided to go to real medical school, and the only places I got in were in California, and I wound up at Stanford and went to medical school there. And interestingly, I spent a year in London and petitioned Stanford to allow me to do an 8-week course at the Royal College of Homeopathy, which they denied. But I touched that as being one of my first evidence of being interested in something alternative or complementary, if you will.
And have you always been just kind of attracted to, I guess, what's commonly known to as out-of-the-box thinking? Was that something that was...
So I think that that's probably true. And then I found myself, after graduating from Stanford, doing my internship and residency at the Kaiser Foundation Hospital in San Francisco, which is really one of our first HMOs in the land back in the 70s, and at that time began to see the first cases of what might be called pre-AIDS. Gay men with swollen glands. I was working with the hematologist, and we more and more saw these patients who had swollen glands, and we didn't know what they were, and I biopsied them to make sure they didn't have lymphoma, and they didn't. And I just told them, move out of the fast lane and see if your lymph nodes disappear. Well, when I then moved on to my fellowship in hematology and oncology at UCSF, that's when we saw our first cases of Kaposi's sarcoma and pneumocystis pneumonia, and we were right there in the epicenter of the AIDS epidemic.
That is just incredible. And so then I would imagine you're looking for anything to help these patients.
Exactly. Because as a gay man myself, this was my community that was impacted. And we had no treatment. So this was 1981. Our first effective treatment was in 1986. AZT was released. So in that five-year period, anything that patients or somebody said might work, high-dose intravenous vitamin C, AL-721. So I became a champion of, quote, alternative therapies. But there was no conventional therapy to be alternative to. And then when AZT was approved in 1986, I said, this isn't very good. And I wrote all the chapters in all the AIDS textbooks on complementary and alternative therapies in HIV/AIDS.
That's incredible. And then you took that into oncology. And
well, there was a missing piece. In 1992, Rick Doblin, who was a Harvard School of Government PhD and also the founder of MAPS, the Multidisciplinary Association for Psychedelic Studies, sent a letter to San Francisco General Hospital, director of research in AIDS, which I actually wasn't, but the letter appeared on my desk, suggesting that we investigate cannabis as a treatment for the AIDS wasting syndrome. So I said, okay, I went to college in the 60s and, you know.
And to Amsterdam.
And I inhaled. So I, you know, I knew what was what. And that began a rather naive interaction with the government when I requested cannabis to do research in patients with this so-called AIDS wasting syndrome, which ultimately the AIDS wasting syndrome disappeared in 1996, which was the same year that the state of California approved medical marijuana. And in 1997, I finally won, and the government sent me $1 million and 1,400 of their finest cigarettes to do research. And during that time, I developed a strong appreciation of the power of plants as medicine, which ultimately took me to the Telluride Mushroom Festival in Telluride, Colorado, a month after I had done my first ever jury duty in San Francisco and come home and said, I want to go to law school. But in Telluride, I met Andrew Weil, the guy with the white beard.
Yes, yes.
You know, and he described a two-year online distance learning fellowship that you could do with his program in integrative medicine from the University of Arizona. And I said, uh-huh, I don't want to go to law school. I want to do that. And I did, and it changed my life.
That is incredible. And what a story.
When I finished my fellowship, I said, I'm done with HIV/AIDS. What I want to do now is integrative oncology, working with people living with and beyond cancer and helping them to integrate these other modalities into their conventional care.
And the other thing, when you talk about the power of plants, things from nature, also the work and some incredible works being done at Yale, as I'm sure you're aware, but the ability of some very old Chinese herbal remedies are actually being tested now and found to work, correct?
Well, yes. I mean, that's how we treat leukemia now with arsenic, for example, which isn't an herbal, but it was in the Chinese medicine armamentarium, and that's how we treat some forms of leukemia. And, you know, as an oncologist, I'm chief of oncology at San Francisco General. I've been an oncologist for 33 years. And as an oncologist, I know some of my most potent chemotherapeutic agents are also derived from plants.
So it's interesting the way that these agents that we don't always know how they're going to interact with patients can interact in unexpected ways, correct?
Absolutely. I mean, you know, nothing is benign in my, you know, even black pepper, which is something that's taken along with turmeric to increase its absorption, increases the absorption of everything else. So people on prescription medications who do take some of these botanical supplements do need to be aware of the potential interactions. And, you know, oncologists will generally say, don't take anything while I'm giving you this chemotherapy. But that's not necessarily the best advice. It's just, you know, reflects that we don't know. And you know, as an oncologist, in 2013, there is this explosion of new therapies. And you can't fault an oncologist for wanting to focus in one particular organ so that they can keep track of all that's there. And so while doing that, they can't keep track of all this so-called integrative oncology. So they're inclined, the more conservative traditional oncologists, to say, just don't do any of that. And in fact, there is increasing evidence that these things do improve, if not quantity of life, certainly patient quality of life.
Now, what you hear a lot of, if you listen to this program, is it's a conversation about the multidisciplinary approach that's being used extensively at Yale. Are you finding that integrative medicine or integrative oncology is now getting a place at the table in those discussions, or is it tough to get involved in that?
Well, we do also have a Society for Integrative Oncology that's having its 10th annual meeting in mid-October in Vancouver. And, you know, this is a large group of people who come together from all over the world. Now, my own experience, when I began my integrative oncology practice at the UCSF Osher Center for Integrative Medicine in 2005, most of my earlier patients were either referred by Andrew Weil or found me through the internet. Our center is right across the street from the Helen Diller Family Comprehensive Cancer Center at the University of California, San Francisco. And now, 8 years later, most of my referrals come from my oncology colleagues across the street.
So you've really now got that place at the table that, you know, that I think can be very valuable for patients. Why has it taken us this long to, you know, start thinking in terms of stuff outside of what we know?
Well, I think it's related to evidence. You know, we are very much evidence-based in modern medicine, and everybody wants the results of the randomized double-blind placebo-controlled trial. And, you know, my passion in this field is nutrition and cancer. JAMA just recently had an article on the state of the nation's health, 1990 to 2010. And the number one cause of morbidity and mortality in the United States over that 20-year period is no longer tobacco. It's dietary issues. And it's dietary issues alone because number four is high body mass index, and number five was lack of physical activity. So it's what we eat. But how do you prove that? I mean, it's very difficult. We cannot do a placebo-controlled trial where this half of the room eats tofu for the next 30 years, and this half eats what? Placebo tofu? People already say tofu tastes like placebo. So, I mean, you can't do the trials to get the kind of evidence. So we like to talk about evidence-informed medicine, which, you know, we use epidemiologic data, we use some animal studies, and we say, well, the probability that this is going to cause harm is low enough that with the evidence that we have, we can make this recommendation. For example, massage. If I'm going to do a study to show that cancer patients benefit from massage, what is my control? You know, you can't, how do you do a control massage? So, you know, it's hard. And Andrew Weil always says, and it's a very controversial statement, but one that I buy into, that the degree of evidence should be directly proportional to the potential for the intervention to do harm. So when I tell a patient, let me give you this new chemotherapy, it's going to make your hair fall out, you're going to be nauseated and vomit for 3 days, and your bone marrow is going to be suppressed, I better have some good evidence that it's going to do that patient some benefit. But again, if I'm going to say eat more broccoli and blueberries and get a massage twice a month, you know, our government can no longer afford to fund those studies to look to see, you know, and what is the potential for harm.
So that is great. Let's continue with that when we come back in just a moment. We're speaking with Dr. Donald Abrams about integrative oncology, and then we'll get into healthy aging also, which I think is very important. This year, over 200,000 Americans will be diagnosed with lung cancer, and in Connecticut alone, there'll be over 2,000 new cases. More than 85% of lung cancer diagnoses are related to smoking, and quitting even after decades of use can significantly reduce your risk of developing lung cancer. Each day, patients with lung cancer are surviving thanks to increased access to advanced therapies and specialized care. New treatment options and surgical techniques are giving lung cancer survivors more hope than they ever had before. Clinical trials are currently underway at federally designated comprehensive cancer centers, like the one at Yale, to test innovative new treatments for lung cancer. An option for lung cancer patients in need of surgery is a video-assisted thoracoscopic surgery, also known as a VATS procedure, which is a minimally invasive technique. This has been a Medical Minute, and more information is available at yalecancercenter.org. You're listening to the WNPR Health Forum on the Connecticut Public Broadcasting Network. I'm Bruce Barber, and for Drs. Anise Chagpar and Francine Foss this week, joined by Dr. Donald Abrams, and we're talking about integrative oncology and healthy aging. You're here from San Francisco. It sounds like you've got a really great job. You're doing, you know, kind of very obviously cutting edge things. You're thinking about things in new ways. That must be fun to come to work in the morning.
Oh yeah, I have two jobs. I'm a Gemini, so I have two very different jobs. I'm chief of hematology oncology at San Francisco General Hospital, which is one of the few true remaining safety net hospitals in the country. So I provide cancer care to indigent adults, very socioeconomically disadvantaged.
Wow.
And multicultural. Two-thirds of my patient interactions in clinic use the interpreter services. And then my other job is integrative oncology consultation at the University of California Osher Center for Integrative Medicine, where all the patients have to be insured, and they're very much more socioeconomically advantaged, a very different patient population. But I often say at San Francisco General Hospital, I treat cancer, and at the Osher Center for Integrative Medicine, I treat people living with cancer. So that's the difference, really.
And what kind of mistakes do nutritionally, let's talk about that specifically, do cancer patients make? Do cancer survivors make sometimes?
Well, I don't know about the mistakes. Part of that, actually, I'll say this out loud for the first time. The American Cancer Society has a cookbook and has a pamphlet for what to eat during chemotherapy, which suggests that cancer patients should eat, for example, angel food cake and ice cream sundaes. They're hoping to get calories in, but more and more evidence is demonstrating that refined carbohydrates and particularly sugar are not good for cancer and, in fact, may be considered cancer fertilizers. So what I recommend that my patients consume is an organic, plant-based, antioxidant-rich, anti-inflammatory whole foods diet. A lot of cancer patients come to me and say, cancer doesn't like an alkaline environment, so I'm going to eat an alkaline diet, for example. And the alkaline diet, after I poo-pooed it for a number of years, I finally looked to see exactly what it is, and it's more fresh fruits and vegetables, less caffeine and alcohol, less red meat, which is essentially the diet that I recommend, but it's the right diet for the wrong reason, because the kidneys keep the pH of our blood in a very narrow range consistent with life, and you're not going to change that by what you eat. And I hate to see patients, desperate patients with cancer, sucked into buying alkaline water, for example, and thinking that that's going to help them.
I would imagine that nutrition and the different types of cancer would interact in different ways.
Well, there are some things. For example, lycopene in tomatoes seems to be very useful for prostate cancer, and similarly pomegranate. But, you know, the very potent foods are the cruciferous vegetables. They contain chemicals, sulforaphane, indole-3-carbinol, and something called DIM, which for women with breast cancer changes their estrogen from the type that drives estrogen-responsive tumors to the type that doesn't. So even for all cancers, I think cruciferous vegetables are really key. And as we speak, I'm drinking green tea. And green tea, I believe, has the second most potent cancer risk-reducing chemicals in it compared to after cruciferous vegetables. And then the antioxidant potency of heavily pigmented fruits, for example, the berries, are also something that we should. And I'm a big fan of deep cold water fish, rich in omega-3 fatty acids, as well as a food source of vitamin D.
And how recently are we starting to understand these types of things, the way that nutrition and things that we don't normally think of interact with the treatment of cancer?
Well, you know, again, some people don't understand it yet. I see a lot of patients who say, well, during radiation therapy, my radiation oncologist said, I can only eat white foods. White foods totally devoid of any antioxidant potential, because there was one study in patients getting radiation therapy where vitamin E supplementation seemed to decrease the side effects of radiation but allowed the cancers to come back quicker and also decrease survival. So that's an antioxidant. So people extrapolate from that and say no antioxidants during radiation, because radiation actually works killing tumor cells by creating free radicals of oxygen.
Well, it sounds to me like we could probably all live better before getting a cancer diagnosis, and that with the knowledge that you've gained, that could be valuable too.
Well, I mean, you talk about healthy aging. The American Institute for Cancer Research, World Cancer Research Fund, has 10 guidelines for reducing the risk of cancer. And number 10 says, for cancer survivors, follow the 9 guidelines above. And number 1 says, be as lean as possible without being underweight. And there it is right there. Obesity is, I believe, the number 1 health problem in the country today. I mean, when I'm medicine attending at San Francisco General, they present a patient to me who has hypertension, diabetes, hyperlipidemia, osteoarthritis, sleep apnea, and then we walk in the room and I see a 300-pound person there. I said, you didn't tell me they're the number 1 problem. You know, we've normalized obesity to the point where we accept it, and it is wrong, and it is a health hazard.
And I would imagine it's a very difficult change to make once you get to that point, correct?
Well, yeah. I mean, you know, because it takes a lot of behavioral modification unless you're going to go get bariatric surgery. But, you know, we live in this quick fix, medicine will take care of it for me by either, you know, doing surgery or giving me a pill, and that's not how some of these things work. For example, recommendation number 2, which is for reducing the risk of cancer, but I think also for growing old healthy, is to be physically active for 30 minutes each day. Now, Time magazine in 2001 did a poll prior to 9/11 of Americans, and more Americans said that it was easier to quit smoking than to do 30 minutes of physical activity each day. And that's a problem. And physical activity does decrease the risk of a number of cancers, prostate, breast, which are very common, and colon, for example. So,
and what are some of the other things that you see and you just wish you could tell people, please think about this before you end up in my office?
Well, you know, the number 3 guideline, let me just tell you, is avoid sugary drinks. And I actually went to the microphone. I said, you know, there are sugary drinks and there are sugary drinks. You could drink a carbonated cola, not to mention any name, or a fruit punch in a can, which probably has glucose and high fructose corn syrup, or you can squeeze 3 oranges in the morning. And the response from the podium was, energetically, they're all the same. Because if you eat an orange, the fiber slows down the absorption of sugar into the bloodstream. But when you squeeze the fiber away from the sugar, it's like drinking a cola beverage. And the problem with that is the body then squirts out insulin and insulin-like growth factor, both of which we now know promote inflammation and cause cancer cells to divide. So I give Michelle Obama a lot of credit right now for going around encouraging people to drink water, because the epidemic of soft drink consumption in this country, I think, contributes a lot to disease. And people say, well, what about, you know, unsweetened or artificially sweetened? Well, I grew up with saccharin, which used to be on the market but then left because of bladder cancer. Maybe it was just in animals. But if you look at the sweetener ingredients in most carbonated beverages, they're all things that have been shown to cause tumors in animals.
And then obviously the 2 big ones that we always hear about, and I'm amazed at their interaction and the way they can cause various types of cancer, are obviously smoking and drinking, you know, smoking tobacco,
right,
and drinking alcohol.
Yeah.
And obviously smoking being, you know, very difficult on its own. But then when you add alcohol to that,
right,
so greatly, increases the risk of so many cancers.
It's true. And the guideline does address alcohol, of course, not tobacco, because this is about things that we eat. And it says, if consumed at all, limit consumption of alcoholic beverages to 2 a day for men and 1 a day for women, which seems quite liberal.
But what impresses me then hearing that, and then the other things, which are behavioral issues that, you know, sometimes require, you know, behavioral modification and everything to get out of them, I would assume that you would be very interested in trying to get this information into the hands of younger people and people starting families on a public health level.
Yeah, I'm a simple oncologist, so I don't think on those terms, but... You know, I'm on the board of a project of a group in Sebastopol, California, called the Ceres Foundation. And what they do is they teach teenagers how to cook healthy food, and then they deliver that to cancer patients. And, you know, that sort of service should be replicated, I think, nationwide, because it helps not only the cancer patients, but, as you say, the next generation learn how to eat healthy food.
What are the, on the more positive side, what are the great things, do you think, that we've learned in the past 5 or 10 years that are really helping both cancer patients and then patients trying to maybe, you know, reduce their risk of getting a cancer? What are the bright spots? What are some of the things that we're doing better now? Or is there anything?
You know, I wish I could say there was. The CDC did a survey about how many Americans eat at least 5 servings, which is very low, of fruits and vegetables each day. And it was a third a quarter eat 3 servings of vegetables and a third eat 2 servings of fruit, which, you know, and of people under the age of 18, it was only 10%. And, you know, if you look at the map of obesity, states' body mass index by state, Colorado used to be the only state that had less than 20% of the adults obese, and now they've moved over. And, you know, I don't know. We live in this culture where we subsidize unhealthy food. My organic apple that I eat every day after lunch costs as much as a double cheeseburger, fries, and a Coke. And until we change that, you know, I don't have a lot of faith that we're making progress. But on the other hand, you know, you go to restaurants. I eat at Maury's, which I hear is a bastion of Yale, and I had tofu, and it was quite tasty. And everything else on the plate, it was vegan, you know. And I don't necessarily eat vegan, but I was surprised to be able, you know. So there's some evidence that consciousness is elevating.
And I think, you know, if it comes from our leaders, you know, and it seems like it is, that, you know, there's at least the chance that we can make some progress in this direction.
You know, I don't follow everything about this, the Affordable Care Act, which I guess is quite important in today's news. But, you know, affordable health care will only come if we focus on wellness and prevention as opposed to find it, fix it, disease management. We don't have a healthcare system. We have a disease management system, and that's very expensive. Physicians don't get compensated for wellness teaching and counseling with patients, and that's a problem.
Dr. Donald Abrams is a cancer specialist at the UCSF Osher Center for Integrative Medicine. If you have questions or comments, we invite you to visit yalecancercenter.org, where you can also get the podcast and find written transcripts of previously broadcast episodes. You're listening to WNPR, Connecticut's public media source for news and ideas.